Chapter 14. Cruel and Unusual. On the morning of May 4, 1989, Michael Gully, 15, and Nathan McCants, 17, convinced 13-year-old Joe Sullivan to accompany them when they broke into an empty house in Pensacola, Florida. The three boys entered the home of Lena Bruner in the morning while no one was there. McCants took some money and jewelry. The three boys then left. That afternoon, Ms. Bruner, an older white woman in her early 70s, was sexually assaulted in her home. Someone knocked on her door, and as she went to open it, another person who had entered through the back of her home grabbed her from behind. It was a violent and shocking rape. Ms. Bruner never even saw her attacker clearly. She could describe him only as quite a dark-colored boy with curly-type hair. Gully, McCants, and Sullivan are all African-American. Within minutes of the assault, Gully and McCants were apprehended together. McCants had Ms. Bruner's jewelry on him. Facing serious felony charges, Gully, who had an extensive criminal history involving at least one sexual offense, accused Joe of the sexual battery. Joe was not apprehended that day, but he voluntarily turned himself in the next day after learning that Gully and McCants had implicated him. Joe admitted helping the older boys with the burglary earlier in the day, but adamantly denied any knowledge of or involvement in the sexual assault. The prosecutor chose to indict 13-year-old Joe Sullivan in adult court for sexual battery and other charges. There was no review of whether Joe should be tried in juvenile or adult court. Florida is one of a few states that allows the prosecutor to decide to charge a child in adult court for certain crimes and has no minimum age for trying a child as an adult. At trial, Joe testified that he had participated in the earlier burglary but had not committed sexual battery. The prosecution relied primarily on the self-serving stories of McCants and Gully, including Gully's claim that Joe had confessed the rape to him in a detention facility before trial. After implicating Joe, McCants was sentenced as an adult to 4.5 years and served just 6 months. Gully, despite admitting his involvement in some 20 prior burglaries and a prior sex crime, was adjudicated and sentenced as a juvenile and spent only a short period of time in a juvenile detention facility. The only physical evidence to implicate Joe was a latent partial palm print that the state's examiner testified matched him. This was consistent with Joe's admitted presence in the bedroom prior to the rape. The police had collected seminal fluid and blood, but the state chose not to present it in court and then destroyed it before it could be tested by the defense. The prosecution also presented testimony from a police officer who got a glimpse of an African-American youth running from the victim's house after he observed Joe Sullivan at the police station being interrogated as the suspect in the sexual assault. He identified Joe as the fleeing youth. Finally, the prosecution presented testimony from the victim, who, despite being coached through a rehearsal of her testimony outside the presence of the jury, could not affirmatively identify Joe Sullivan as the perpetrator. Joe was made to say in court what the victim remembered her assailant saying to her, but she testified that Joe's voice could very easily be that of the perpetrator. Joe was convicted by a 6-person jury after a trial that lasted only one day. Opening statements began sometime after 9 a.m., and the jury returned its verdict at 4:55 p.m. Joe's appointed counsel was later suspended from practice in Florida and never reinstated. The defense lawyer had filed no written pleadings and uttered no more than 12 transcript lines at sentencing. There was a great deal to say that was never said. At the time of his arrest in 1989, Joe Sullivan was a 13-year-old boy with mental disabilities who read at a first-grade level, had experienced repeated physical abuse by his father, and had suffered severe neglect. His family had disintegrated into what state officials described as abuse and chaos. From age 10 until his arrest, Joe had no stable home. He had no fewer than 10 different addresses within this 3-year period. He spent most of his time on the streets, where police stopped him for violations including trespassing, stealing a bike, and property crimes committed with his older brother and other older teens. Joe had been brought to court and adjudicated on a single occasion when he was 12 years old. The juvenile probation officer assigned to Joe's case attributed his behavior to the fact that he's easily influenced and associates with the wrong crowd. She observed that it is apparent that Joe is a very immature, naive person who is a follower rather than a leader, and that he has the potential to be a positive and productive individual. Joe's record of mostly misdemeanor-level juvenile incidents, nearly all of which were nonviolent and which did not merit more than a single court adjudication in a 2-year period, was viewed differently by the sentencing judge, who concluded that the juvenile system has been utterly incapable of doing anything with Mr. Sullivan. The court concluded that Joe had been given opportunity after opportunity to upright himself and take advantage of the second and third chances he's been given. In truth, Joe was never given a second, much less a third chance to upright himself, but he was nonetheless characterized at age 13 as a serial or violent recidivist by prosecutors. The judge sentenced him to life imprisonment without the possibility of parole. Despite numerous potentially meritorious grounds for appeal, Joe's appointed appellate counsel filed an Anders brief, indicating his belief that there were no legitimate grounds for appeal and no credible basis to complain about the conviction or sentence, and was permitted to withdraw from representing Joe. Joe, just 1 year into his own adolescence, was sent to adult prison, where an 18-year nightmare began. In prison, he was repeatedly raped and sexually assaulted. He attempted suicide on multiple occasions. He developed multiple sclerosis, which eventually forced him into a wheelchair. Doctors later concluded that his neurological disorder might have been triggered by trauma in prison. Another inmate housed with Joe wrote to us and described him as disabled, horribly mistreated, and wrongfully condemned to die in prison for a non-homicide crime at 13. In 2007, we wrote to Joe and discovered that he had no legal assistance and had spent the previous 18 years in prison with no one to help him challenge his conviction or sentence. When I received Joe's response to my letter, a scribbled note in the handwriting of a child, he could still only read at a third grade level, despite the fact that he was 31. He told me in his letter that he was okay. Then he wrote, "If I didn't do anything, shouldn't I be able to go home now? Mr. Bryan, if this is true, can you please write me back and come get me?" I wrote to Joe that we would look deeper into his case and that we were convinced that he had a credible claim of innocence. We attempted to prove his innocence through a motion for DNA testing, but because the state had destroyed the relevant biological evidence, the motion was denied. Disheartened, we decided to challenge Joe's death in prison sentence as unconstitutionally cruel and unusual punishment. I drove from Montgomery through South Alabama to Florida, and then along a tangle of wooded back roads to get to the Santa Rosa Correctional Facility in the town of Milton to meet Joe for the first time. Santa Rosa County borders the Gulf of Mexico at the western end of the Florida Panhandle and had long been known for agriculture. Between 1980 and 2000, the county's population doubled in size as the coastal areas attracted beach homes and resort properties. Many affluent families left Pensacola for Santa Rosa County, and military families from nearby Eglin Air Force Base settled there. But there was another industry in town, incarceration. The Florida Department of Corrections built the prison to house 1,600 people in the 1990s, when America was opening prisons at a pace never before seen in human history. Between 1990 and 2005, a new prison opened in the United States every 10 days. Prison growth and the resulting prison industrial complex, the business interests that capitalize on prison construction, made imprisonment so profitable that millions of dollars were spent lobbying state legislators to keep expanding the use of incarceration to respond to just about any problem. Incarceration became the answer to everything. Healthcare problems like drug addiction, poverty that had led someone to write a bad check, child behavioral disorders, managing the mentally disabled poor. Even immigration issues generated responses from legislators that involved sending people to prison. Never before had so much lobbying money been spent to expand America's prison population, block sentencing reforms, create new crime categories, and sustain the fear and anger that fuel mass incarceration than during the last 25 years in the United States. When I arrived at Santa Rosa, I didn't encounter any staff who were people of color, although 70% of the men incarcerated there were black or brown. This was a bit unusual. I frequently saw black and brown correctional officers at other prisons. I was subjected to an elaborate admission process and given a beeper to activate if I was ever threatened or distressed while inside the prison. I was escorted to a 40-by-40-foot room where more than 24 incarcerated men sat sadly while uniformed correctional staff buzzed in and out. There were 3 6-foot-tall metal cages in the corner that couldn't have been more than 4 feet by 4 feet. In all my years of visiting prisons, I'd never seen such small cages used to hold a prisoner inside a secure prison. I wondered what danger the caged men presented that they couldn't sit with the other incarcerated men on the benches. 2 young men stood in each of the first 2 cages. In the 3rd cage, which was wedged into the corner, sat a small man in a wheelchair. His wheelchair faced the back of the cage, so he could not look out into the room. I couldn't see his face, but I was certain it was Joe. A correctional officer was constantly walking into the room and calling out a name, prompting one of the men to get up from his bench and follow the officer down a hallway where he would meet with an assistant warden or whomever they were scheduled to see. Finally, the officer called out, "Joe Sullivan, legal visit." I walked over to the man and said that I was the attorney for the legal visit. He summoned 2 officers who went to Joe's cage to unlock it. The cage was so small that when they tried to remove Joe's wheelchair, the spokes on the chair got caught on the cage, and they couldn't budge it. I stood there watching for several minutes while more officers got involved in an increasingly elaborate effort to dislodge Joe's wheelchair from the tight cage. They pulled up on the wheelchair. Then they pushed down on the chair, raising the front off the ground, but this didn't work either. They tugged at the chair with loud grunts and tried to force it free, but it was completely stuck. 2 inmate trustees who had been mopping the floor stopped to watch the officers struggle with the wheelchair and the cage. They finally offered to help out, even though no one had asked for their input. The officers silently accepted the assistance of the inmates, but none of them could come up with a solution. As the staff became more frustrated by their inability to get Joe out of the cage, there was talk of using pliers and hacksaws, of putting the cage on its side with Joe in it. Someone suggested trying to lift Joe from his wheelchair to remove him without the chair, but both Joe and the chair were packed so tightly into the cage that no one could get in to move him. I asked the guards why he was in the cage in the first place, which prompted a brusque response. "Lifer. All lifers have to be moved with higher security protocols." I couldn't see Joe's face while all of this was going on, but I could hear him crying. He occasionally made a whining sound, and his shoulders jerked up and down. When the staff proposed turning the cage on its side, he moaned audibly. Finally, the prisoner trustee suggested lifting the cage and tilting it slightly, which everyone agreed to try. The 2 trustees lifted and tilted the heavy cage, while 3 officers yanked Joe's chair with a violent pull that finally dislodged it. The guards gave each other high fives. The inmate trustees walked away silently, and Joe sat motionlessly in his chair in the middle of the room, looking down at his feet. I walked over to him and introduced myself. His face was tear-stained, and his eyes were red. But he looked up at me and began clapping his hands giddily. "Yay, yay, Mr. Bryan!" He smiled and offered me both of his hands, which I took. I wheeled Joe to a cramped office for our legal visit. He continued cheering quietly and kept clapping his hands in excitement. I had to argue with the attending prison guard for permission to close the door and talk confidentially with Joe. The officer eventually relented. Joe seemed to relax when I closed the door. Despite the terrifying start to the visit, he was extremely cheerful. I couldn't shake the feeling that I was talking to a young child. I explained to Joe how disappointed we were that the state had destroyed the biological evidence that might have allowed us to prove he was innocent through DNA testing. We had discovered that both the victim and one of his co-defendants had died. The other co-defendant would not say anything about what had really happened, making it extremely difficult for us to challenge Joe's conviction. I then offered our new idea about challenging his sentence as unconstitutional, which might create another way for him to possibly go home. He smiled throughout my explanation, although it was clear he didn't understand all of it. He had a legal pad on his lap, and when I finished, he told me that he had prepared some questions for our visit. During the entire visit, I kept thinking about how he was much more enthusiastic and excited than I'd expected him to be, given his history. When he told me about the questions he had prepared for me, he was practically bubbling. He explained that if he ever got out of prison, he might want to be a reporter, so I can tell people what's really going on. He spoke with great pride when he announced that he was ready to ask his questions. "Joe, I'll be happy to answer any questions. Fire away." He read with some difficulty. "Do you have children?" He looked up at me expectantly. "No, I don't have children. I have nieces and nephews, though." "What is your favorite color?" He once again smiled eagerly. I chuckled since I don't have a favorite color, but I wanted to respond to him. "Brown." "Okay, my last question is the most important." He looked up at me briefly with big eyes and smiled. He then became serious and read his question. "Who is your favorite cartoon character?" He was beaming when he looked at me. "Please tell the truth. I really want to know." I couldn't think of anything and had to force myself to keep smiling. "Wow, Joe, I honestly don't know. Can I think about that and get back to you? I'll write you with my answer." He nodded enthusiastically. Over the next 3 months, I received a flood of scrawled letters from Joe, one almost every day. The letters were usually short statements about what he'd eaten that day or what show he'd seen on television. Sometimes there were just two or three Bible verses he had copied. He would always ask me to write him back and let him know if his handwriting was improving. Sometimes the letters contained only a few words or a single question like, "Do you have friends?" We filed a petition to challenge Joe's sentence as unconstitutionally cruel and unusual punishment. We knew that there would be procedural objections to filing it nearly 20 years after his sentencing, but we thought the Supreme Court's recent decision banning the death penalty for juveniles could provide a basis for relief. In 2005, the court recognized that differences between children and adults required that kids be shielded from the death penalty under the Eighth Amendment. My staff and I discussed how we might use the constitutional reasoning that banned the execution of children as a legal basis for challenging juvenile life without parole sentences. We filed similar challenges to life without parole sentences in several other cases involving children, including Ian Manuel's case. Ian was still being held in solitary confinement in Florida. We filed cases in Missouri, Michigan, Iowa, Mississippi, North Carolina, Arkansas, Delaware, Wisconsin, Nebraska, and South Dakota. We filed a case in Pennsylvania to help Trina Garnett, the girl who had been convicted for arson. She was still struggling at the women's prison but was excited about the possibility of our doing something to change her sentence. We filed a case in California for Antonio Nunez. We filed two cases in Alabama. Ashley Jones was a 14-year-old girl who had been convicted of killing two family members when her older boyfriend tried to help her escape her family. Ashley suffered from a horrific history of abuse and neglect. When she was still a teenager serving her sentence at the Tutwiler Prison for Women, She started writing to me to ask about various legal decisions she'd read about in the newspaper. She never asked for legal assistance. She simply asked about what she'd read and expressed interest in the law and our work. She started sending notes congratulating me and EJI whenever we won a death penalty appeal. When we decided to challenge death in prison sentences imposed on children, I told her we might be able to finally challenge her sentence. She was thrilled. Evan Miller was another 14-year-old condemned to die in prison in Alabama. Evan is from a poor white family in North Alabama. His difficult life was punctuated by suicide attempts that started at age 7 when he was in elementary school. His parents were abusive and had drug addiction problems, so he was in and out of foster care, but he was living with his mother at the time of the crime. A middle-aged neighbor, Cole Cannon, had come over one night seeking to buy drugs from Evan's mother. The 14-year-old Evan and his 16-year-old friend went to the man's house with him to play cards. Cannon gave the teens drugs and played drinking games with them. At one point, he sent the boys out to buy more drugs. The boys returned and stayed over as it got later and later. Eventually, the boys thought Cannon had passed out and tried to steal his wallet. Cannon was startled awake and jumped on Evan. The older boy responded by hitting the man in the head with a bat. Both boys started beating him and then set his trailer on fire. Cole Cannon died, and Evan and his friend were charged with capital murder. The older boy made a deal with prosecutors and got a parole-eligible life sentence, while Evan was convicted and sentenced to life imprisonment without parole. I got involved in Evan's case right after his trial and filed a motion to reduce his sentence, even though it was the mandatory punishment for someone convicted of capital murder who was too young to be executed. At a hearing, I asked the judge to reconsider Evan's sentence in light of his age. The prosecutor argued, "I think he should be executed. He deserves the death penalty." He then lamented that the law no longer authorized the execution of children because he just couldn't wait to put this 14-year-old boy in the electric chair and kill him. The judge denied our motion. When I visited Evan at the jail, we would have long talks. He loved to talk about anything he could think of when we were together to extend our visits. We talked about sports and exercise. We talked about books. We talked about his family. We talked about music. We talked about all the things he wanted to do when he grew up. He was usually animated and excited about something. Although when he didn't hear from his family for a while or had to deal with some bad incident at the prison, he would become extremely depressed. He couldn't understand some of the hostile and violent behavior he saw from prisoners and the other people around him. He once told me that a guard had punched him in the chest just because he had asked a question about mealtimes. He started crying as he told me this because he just couldn't understand why the officer had done that. Evan was sent to the St. Clair Correctional Facility, a maximum security adult prison. Not long after he first arrived, he was attacked by another prisoner, who stabbed him 9 times. He recovered without serious physical problems, but was traumatized by the experience and disoriented by the violence. When he talked about his own act of violence, he seemed deeply confused about how it was possible he could have done something so destructive. Most of the juvenile lifer cases we handled involved clients who shared Evan's confusion about their adolescent behavior. Many had matured into adults who were much more thoughtful and reflective. They were now capable of making responsible and appropriate decisions. Almost all of the cases involved condemned people, marked by the tragic irony that they were now nothing like the confused children who had committed a violent crime. They had all changed in some significant way. This made them distinct from most of my clients who committed crimes as adults. That I was involved in the cases of teens who'd committed violent crimes was itself ironic. I was 16 years old, living in southern Delaware. I was headed outside one day when our phone rang. I watched my mother answer it as I strolled past her. A minute later, I heard her scream inside the house. I ran back inside and saw her lying on the floor sobbing, "Daddy, Daddy," while the phone's receiver dangled from its base. I picked it up. My aunt was on the line. She told me that my grandfather had been murdered. My grandparents had been separated for many years, and my grandfather had for some time lived alone in the South Philadelphia housing projects. It was there that he was attacked and stabbed to death by several teens who had broken into his apartment to steal his black and white television set. He was 86 years old. Our large family was devastated by his senseless murder. My grandmother, who had separated from my grandfather many years earlier, was especially unnerved by the crime and his death. I had older cousins who worked in law enforcement and sought information about the boys who committed the crime. I remember them being more astonished than vengeful about the immaturity and lack of judgment the juveniles had demonstrated. We all kept saying and thinking the same thing. They didn't have to kill him. There was no way an 86-year-old man could have stopped them from getting away with their paltry loot. My mother could never make sense of it, and neither could I. I knew kids at school who seemed out of control and violent, but I still wondered how someone could be so pointlessly destructive. My grandfather's murder left us with so many questions. Now, decades later, I was starting to understand. In preparing litigation on behalf of the children we were representing, it was clear that these shocking and senseless crimes couldn't be evaluated honestly without understanding the lives these children had been forced to endure. And in banning the death penalty for juveniles, the Supreme Court had paid great attention to the emerging body of medical research about adolescent development and brain science and its relevance to juvenile crime and culpability. Contemporary neurological, psychological, and sociological evidence has established that children are impaired by immature judgment and underdeveloped capacity for self-regulation and responsibility, vulnerability to negative influences and outside pressures, and a lack of control over their own impulses and their environment. Generally considered to encompass ages 12 to 18, adolescence is defined by radical transformation, including the obvious and often distressing physical changes associated with puberty, increases in height and weight and sex-related changes, as well as progressive gains in the capacity for reasoned and mature judgment, impulse control, and autonomy. As we later explained to the court, experts had come to the following conclusion. A rapid and dramatic increase in the dopaminergic activity within the socio-emotional system around the time of puberty drives the young adolescent toward increased sensation-seeking and risk-taking. This increase in reward-seeking precedes the structural maturation of the cognitive control system and its connections to areas of the socio-emotional system. A maturational process that is gradual unfolds over the course of adolescence and permits more advanced self-regulation and impulse control. The temporal gap between the arousal of the socio-emotional system, which is an early adolescent development, and the full maturation of the cognitive control system, which occurs later, creates a period of heightened vulnerability to risk-taking during middle adolescence. These biological and psychosocial developments explain what is obvious to parents, teachers, and any adult who reflects on his or her own teenage years. Young teens lack the maturity, independence, and future orientation that adults have acquired. It seemed odd to have to explain in a court of law something so fundamental about childhood, but the commitment to harsh punishments for children was so intense and reactionary that we had to articulate these basic facts. We argued in court that, relative to that of adults, young teenage judgment is handicapped in nearly every conceivable way. Young adolescents lack life experience and background knowledge to inform their choices. They struggle to generate options and to imagine consequences. And perhaps for good reason, they lack the necessary self-confidence to make reasoned judgments and stick by them. We argued that neuroscience and the new information about brain chemistry help explain the impaired judgment that teens often display. When these basic deficits that burden all children are combined with the environments that some poor children experience, environments marked by abuse, violence, dysfunction, neglect, and the absence of loving caretakers, adolescents can leave kids vulnerable to the sort of extremely poor decision-making that results in tragic violence. We were able to make persuasive arguments about the differences between children and adults, but that wasn't the only obstacle to relief. The Supreme Court's Eighth Amendment precedent requires not only that a particular sentence offend evolving standards of decency, but also that it be unusual. In the cases where the Supreme Court had previously granted relief under the Eighth Amendment, the number of sentences challenged usually totaled fewer than 100 or so nationwide. In 2002, there were about 100 people with mental retardation facing execution when the court banned the death penalty for people with intellectual disability. In 2005, there were fewer than 75 juvenile offenders on death row when the court banned the death penalty for kids. Even smaller numbers accompanied the court's decisions banning the death penalty for non-homicide offenses. Our litigation strategy was complicated by the fact that more than 2,500 children in the United States had been sentenced to life imprisonment without parole. We decided to focus on two subsets of kids to help the court grant relief if it wasn't ready to ban all life sentences without parole for juveniles. We focused on the youngest kids, who were 13 and 14. There were fewer than 100 children under the age of 15 who had been sentenced to life imprisonment without parole. We also focused on the children who, like Joe Sullivan, Ian Manuel, and Antonio Nunez, had been convicted of non-homicide offenses. Most juveniles sentenced to life imprisonment without parole had been convicted of homicide crimes. We estimated there were fewer than 200 juvenile offenders serving life without parole for non-homicide offenses. We argued that the ban on the death penalty had implications because a death-in-prison sentence is also a terminal, unchangeable, once-and-for-all judgment on the whole life of a human being that declares him or her forever unfit to be part of civil society. We asked courts to recognize that such a judgment cannot rationally be passed on children below a certain age because they are unfinished products, human works in progress. They stand at a peculiarly vulnerable moment in their lives. Their potential for growth and change is enormous. Almost all of them will outgrow criminal behavior, and it is practically impossible to detect the few who will not. They are the products of an environment over which they have no real control. Passengers through narrow pathways in a world they never made, as we wrote in our brief. We emphasized the incongruity of not allowing children to smoke, drink, vote, drive without restrictions, give blood, buy guns, and a range of other behaviors because of their well-recognized lack of maturity and judgment, while simultaneously treating some of the most at risk, neglected, and impaired children exactly the same as full-grown adults in the criminal justice system. Initially, we had little success with these arguments. Joe Sullivan's judge ruled that our claims were meritless. In other states, we were met with similar skepticism and resistance. Eventually, we exhausted options provided by the state of Florida in Joe Sullivan's case and filed an appeal in the U.S. Supreme Court. In May 2009, the Supreme Court agreed to review the case. It felt like a miracle. Review in the Supreme Court is rare enough, but the possibility that the court might create constitutional relief for children sentenced to die in prison made this opportunity even more thrilling. It was a chance to change the rules across the country. The court granted review in Joe's case and in another Florida case that involved a 16-year-old teen convicted of a non-homicide and sentenced to life with no parole. Terrence Graham was from Jacksonville, Florida, and had been on probation when he was accused of trying to rob a store. As a result of his new arrest, the judge revoked Terrence's probation and sentenced him to die in prison. Because both Joe's case and the Graham case involved non-homicides, it was likely that if we won a favorable ruling from the court, it would only apply to life without parole sentences imposed on juveniles convicted of non-homicides, but that was an exciting possibility. The cases generated a lot of national media attention. When we filed our brief in the U.S. Supreme Court, national organizations joined us and filed amicus briefs urging the court to rule in our favor. we received support from the American Psychological Association, the American Psychiatric Association, the American Bar Association, the American Medical Association, former judges, former prosecutors, social workers, civil rights groups, human rights groups, even some victims' rights groups. Former juvenile offenders who had later become well-known public figures filed supporting documents, including very conservative politicians like former U.S. Senator Alan Simpson from Wyoming. Simpson had spent 18 years in the Senate, including 10 as the Republican whip, the second-ranking senator in his party. He had also been a former juvenile felon. He had been adjudicated as a juvenile delinquent when he was 17 for multiple convictions for arson, theft, aggravated assault, gun violence, and finally assaulting a police officer. He later confessed, "I was a monster." His life didn't begin to change until he found himself imprisoned in a sea of puke and urine following another arrest. Senator Simpson knew firsthand that you cannot judge a person's full potential by his juvenile misconduct. Another brief was filed on behalf of former child soldiers, whose terrifying behavior after being forced into violent African militias made the crimes of our clients seem much less aggravated by comparison. Yet, these former child soldiers, rescued from their armies, had mostly recovered and been widely embraced at American colleges and universities where many of them had thrived. In November 2009, after the briefs were filed in Joe's case and the Graham case, I went to Washington for my third U.S. Supreme Court oral argument. There was a lot more media attention and national news coverage than in any of my earlier cases. The court was packed. There were hundreds of people outside the court as well. A wide assortment of children's rights advocates, lawyers, and mental health experts were watching closely when we asked the court to declare life without parole sentences imposed on children unconstitutional. During the argument, the court was feisty, and it was impossible to predict what the justices were going to do. I told the court that the United States is the only country in the world that imposes life imprisonment without parole sentences on children. I explained that condemning children violates international law, which bans these sentences for children. We showed the court that these sentences are disproportionately imposed on children of color. We argue that the phenomenon of life sentences imposed on children is largely a result of harsh punishments that were created for career adult criminals and were never intended for children, which made the imposition of such a sentence on juveniles like Terrence Graham and Joe Sullivan unusual. I also told the court that to say to any child of 13 that he is fit only to die in prison is cruel. I had no way of knowing if the court had been persuaded. I had promised Joe, whose name and case were constantly being discussed on television, that I would visit him after the argument in the Supreme Court. At first, Joe was very excited by all the attention his case was generating, but then the guards and other prisoners started making fun of him and treating him more harshly than usual. They seemed to resent the attention he was getting. I told him that now that the argument was over, things would calm down. For weeks, he'd been working on memorizing a poem he said he'd written. When I asked if he'd really written it, he acknowledged that another inmate helped him, but his excitement about the poem was undiminished. He had repeatedly promised that he would recite it for me when I visited him after the argument. When I arrived at the prison, Joe was wheeled into the visitation area without any difficulty. I talked to him about the argument in Washington, but he was much more interested in preparing me to hear his poem. I could tell he was nervous about whether he'd be able to do it. I cut short my report about his case so I could hear his poem. He closed his eyes to concentrate, and then he began to recite the lines. "Roses are red, violets are blue, soon I'll come home to live with you. My life will be better, happy I'll be. You'll be like my dad and my family. We'll have fun with our friends, and others will see. I'm a good person. He couldn't remember the last line. He looked up at the ceiling, then at the floor, straining to remember. He squeezed his eyes, trying to force the last words to mind, but they wouldn't come. I was tempted to supply him a line just to help him get through it. So be happy for me, or now people will see. But I realized that creating a line for him wasn't the right thing to do, so I just sat there. Finally, he seemed to accept that he wouldn't remember the line. I thought he'd be upset, but when it was clear that he wouldn't remember the last line, he just started laughing. I smiled at him, relieved. For some reason, it became funnier and funnier to him that he couldn't think of the last line, until he abruptly stopped laughing and looked at me. Oh, wait! I think the last line... Actually, I think the last line is just what I said. The last line is just, I'm a good person. He paused, and I looked at him skeptically for several seconds. I said it before I thought about it. Really? I should have stopped, but I continued. We'll have fun with our friends, and others will see. I'm a good person? He looked at me for an instant with a serious expression, and then we both broke out simultaneously in wild laughter. I wasn't sure I should be laughing, but Joe was laughing, which made me think it was okay. Honestly, I couldn't help it. In a few seconds, we were both in hysterics. He was rocking in his wheelchair from side to side with laughter, clapping his hands. I couldn't stop laughing either. I was trying hard to stop, but failing. We looked at each other as we laughed. I watched Joe, who laughed like a little boy, but I saw the lines in his face and even the emergence of a few prematurely gray hairs on his head. I realized even while I laughed that his unhappy childhood had been followed by unhappy, imprisoned teenage years, followed by unhappy incarceration through young adulthood. All of a sudden, it occurred to me what a miracle it was that he could still laugh. I thought about how wrong the world is about Joe Sullivan, and how much I wanted to win his case. We both finally calmed down. I tried to speak as sincerely as I could manage. Joe, it's a very, very nice poem. I paused. I think it's beautiful. He beamed at me and clapped his hands. Chapter 15. Broken. Walter's decline came quickly. The moments of confusion got longer and longer. He started forgetting things he had done just a few hours earlier. The details of his business slipped away from him, and managing work became complicated in ways he couldn't understand, which depressed him. At some point, I went over his records with him, and he'd been selling things at a fraction of their worth and losing a lot of money. A film crew from Ireland came to Alabama to make a short documentary about the death penalty that would feature Walter's case and the cases of two other Alabama death row prisoners. James Bo Cochran had been released after spending nearly 20 years on Alabama's death row. A new trial was awarded after federal courts reversed his conviction because of racial bias during jury selection. At his new trial, a racially diverse jury found him not guilty of murder, and he was freed. The third man featured in the film, Robert Tarver, also adamantly maintained his innocence. The prosecutor later admitted that his jury had been illegally selected in a racially discriminatory manner, but courts refused to review the claim because the defense lawyer failed to make an adequate objection, so Tarver was executed. We hosted a premiere of the film at our office, and I invited Walter and Beau to address the audience. About 75 people from the community gathered in EJI's meeting room, where we screened the film. Walter struggled. He was more terse than usual, and looked at me frantically whenever someone asked him a question. I told him that he wouldn't have to do any more presentations. His sister told me that he'd started wandering in the evenings and getting lost. He began drinking heavily, something he'd never done before. He told me that he was anxious all the time and that the alcohol calmed his nerves. Then one day, he collapsed. He was at a hospital in Mobile when they reached me in Montgomery. I drove down to speak with his doctor, who told me that Walter had advancing dementia, likely trauma-induced, and that he would need constant care. The doctor also said the dementia would progress and that Walter would likely become incapacitated. We met with Walter's family at our office and agreed that he should move to Huntsville to live with a relative who could provide consistent care. It worked for a while, but Walter became agitated there, and he was out of money, so he moved back to Monroeville, where his sister Katie Lee agreed to watch him. For a while, he did much better in Monroeville, but then his condition began to deteriorate again. Soon, Walter needed to be moved into the sort of facility that provided care for the elderly and infirm. Most places wouldn't take him because he had been convicted of a felony. Even when we explained that he was wrongfully convicted and later proved innocent, we couldn't get anyone to admit him. EJI now had a social worker on staff, Mariah Morrison, who began working with Walter and his family to find a suitable placement for him. It was an extremely frustrating and maddening process. Mariah eventually found a place in Montgomery that agreed to take Walter for a short stay, no longer than 90 days. He went there while we figured out what to do next. The whole thing made me incredibly sad. Our workload was increasing too quickly. I had just argued Joe Sullivan's case at the U.S. Supreme Court, and I was anxiously awaiting that judgment. The Alabama Supreme Court had scheduled execution dates for several death row prisoners who had completed the appeals process. For years, we'd been fearing what would happen when a sizable number of condemned prisoners exhausted their appeals. More than a dozen people were now vulnerable to execution dates, and we knew that it would be extremely difficult to block those executions given the current legal climate in Alabama, combined with the limits on federal court review in capital cases. I met with our staff, and we made the difficult decision to represent all of the people who were scheduled for execution and didn't have counsel. A few weeks later, I found myself deeply distressed. I was worried about the execution dates that were set for every other month in Alabama. I was worried about what the U.S. Supreme Court would do with all of the children condemned to die in prison, now that it had the issue to consider. I was worried about our funding and whether we had enough staff and resources to meet the demands of our expanding docket. I was worried about several clients who were struggling. When I got to the Montgomery nursing home to see Walter a week after he'd arrived there, I felt like I'd been worrying all day. Walter sat in a common room with older, heavily medicated people watching TV. It was jarring to see him sitting in a hospital gown among people so compromised and infirm. I stopped before I walked into the room and looked at him. He hadn't seen me yet. He looked sleepy and unhappy, slumped in a reclining chair. His head rested on his hand. He was staring in the general direction of the television, but it didn't seem like he was watching the program. He wasn't shaved, and something he'd eaten had crusted on his chin. There was a sadness in his eyes I'd never seen before. Looking at him, I felt my heart sink. A part of me wanted to leave. A nurse saw me standing outside the room and asked if I was there to see someone. I told her I was, and she smiled sympathetically. When the nurse escorted me into the room, I walked up to Walter and put my hand on his shoulder. He stirred and looked up, then gave me a broad smile. "Hey, there he is!" He sounded cheerful, and suddenly he looked like himself. He started laughing and stood up. I gave him a hug. I was relieved. He hadn't recognized some family members recently. "How you doing?" I asked him while he leaned on me slightly. "Well, you know, I'm doing okay." We started walking to his room where we could talk privately. "Are you feeling better?" It was not a sensible question, but I was a little unnerved seeing Walter like this. He'd lost weight, and his gown wasn't tied in the back, which he didn't seem to notice. I stopped him. "Wait, let me help you out." I tied the strings on his gown and we continued to his room. He moved slowly and cautiously, sliding his feet and his slippers across the floor as if he'd forgotten how to pick them up. He grabbed my arm a few feet down the hall and leaned on me as we slowly made our way. "Well, I told them people I got plenty of cars, plenty of cars." He spoke emphatically, with much more excitement than I'd heard from him in a while. "All different colors, shapes, and sizes. The man say, your cars don't work. I told him my cars do work, too. He looked at me. You may have to talk to that man about my cars, okay? I nodded and thought of his field of metal. You do have lots of cars. I know, he cut me off and started laughing. See, I told them people, but they didn't believe me. I told them. He was smiling and chuckling now, but he looked confused and not himself. Them people think I don't know what I'm talking about, but I know exactly what I'm talking about. He spoke defiantly. We reached his room and he sat down on his bed while I pulled up a chair. He became still and quiet and suddenly looked very worried. Well, looks like I'm back here, he said with a heavy sigh. They done put me back on death row. His voice was mournful. I tried, but they just won't let me be. He looked me in the eye. Why they want to do somebody like they're doing me is something I'll never understand. Why are people like that? I mind my own business. I don't hurt nobody. I try to do right. And no matter what I do, people come along and put me back on death row. For nothing. Nothing. I ain't done nothing to nobody. Nothing. 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 He was becoming agitated, so I put my hand on his arm. Hey, it's okay, I said as gently as I could. It's not as bad as it seems. I think you're going to get me out, right? You're going to get me off the row again. Walter, this isn't the row. You haven't been feeling well, and so you're here so you can get better. This is a hospital. They've got me again. You've got to help me. He was starting to panic, and I wasn't sure what to do. Then he started crying. Please, get me out of here, please. They're going to execute me for no good reason. I don't want to die in no electric chair. He was crying now with a forcefulness that alarmed me. I moved to the bed next to him and put my arm around him. It's okay. It's okay. Walter, it's going to be all right. It's going to be all right. He was trembling, and I got up so that he could lie down. He stopped crying as his head hit the pillow. I began talking to him softly about trying to make arrangements so he could stay at home, and how we needed to find help, and that the problem was that it really wasn't safe for him to be alone. I could see his eyes drooping as I spoke, and within a matter of minutes he was sound asleep. I'd been with him less than 20 minutes. I pulled his blankets up and watched him sleep. In the hallway, I asked one of the nurses how he'd been doing. He's really sweet, she said. We love having him here. He's nice to the staff, very polite and gentle. Sometimes he gets upset and starts talking about prison and death row. We didn't know what he was talking about, but one of the girls looked him up on the internet, and that's when we read what happened to him. Somebody said someone like that is not supposed to be here, but I told them that our job is to help anybody who needs help. Well, the state acknowledged that he didn't do anything wrong. He is innocent. The nurse looked at me sweetly. I know, Mr. Stevenson, but a lot of people here think that once you go to prison, whether you belong there or not, you become a dangerous person, and they don't want to have nothing to do with you. Well, that's a shame. It was all I could muster. I left the facility shaken and disturbed. My cell phone rang as soon as I stepped outside. The Alabama Supreme Court had just scheduled another death row prisoner's execution. One of EJI's best lawyers was now serving as our deputy director. Randy Suskin interned with us as a law student when he was at Georgetown University and became a staff attorney right out of law school. He proved to be an outstanding litigator and an extremely effective project manager. I called Randy and we discussed what we would do to block the execution, although we both knew that it was going to be difficult to obtain a stay at this stage. I told Randy about my visit with Walter and how painful it had been to see him. We were silent on the phone for a while, something that happens a lot when we talk. The increasing rate of executions in Alabama went against the national trend. Media coverage of all the innocent people wrongly convicted had an effect on the death sentencing rate in America, which began to decline in 1999. But the terrorist attacks in New York City on September 11, 2001, and threats of terrorism and global conflict seemed to disrupt the progress toward a repeal of capital punishment. But then a few years later, rates of execution and death sentencing were once again decreasing. By 2010, the number of annual executions fell to less than half the number in 1999. Several states were seriously debating ending the death penalty. New Jersey, New York, Illinois, New Mexico, Connecticut, and Maryland all took capital punishment off the books. Even in Texas, where nearly 40% of the nearly 1,400 modern-era executions in the United States had taken place, the death sentencing rate had dropped dramatically, and the pace of executions had finally slowed. Alabama's death sentencing rate had also dropped from the late 1990s, but it was still the highest in the country. By the end of 2009, Alabama had the nation's highest execution rate per capita. Every other month, someone was facing execution, and we were scrambling to keep up. Jimmy Callahan, Danny Bradley, Max Payne, Jack Trawick, and Willie McNair were executed in 2009. We had actively tried to block these executions, mostly by arguing about the way the executions were being carried out. In 2004, I argued a case at the U.S. Supreme Court that raised questions about the constitutionality of certain methods of execution. States had largely abandoned execution by electrocution, gas chamber, firing squad, and hanging in favor of lethal injection. Viewed as more sterile and serene, lethal injection had become the most common method for the sanctioned killing of people in virtually every death state. But questions about the painlessness and efficacy of lethal injection were emerging. In the case I argued before the court, we challenged the constitutionality of Alabama's protocols for lethal injection. David Nelson had very compromised veins. He was in his 60s and had been a drug addict earlier in his life, making access to his veins difficult. Members of the correctional staff were not able to insert an IV in his arm in order to carry out his execution without medical complications. The Hippocratic Oath prevents doctors and medical personnel from participating in executions, so Alabama officials planned for untrained correctional staff to take a knife and make a 2-inch incision in Mr. Nelson's arm or groin so that they could find a vein in which to inject him with toxins and kill him. We argued that without anesthesia, the procedure would be needlessly painful and cruel. The state of Alabama had argued that procedural rules barred Mr. Nelson from challenging the constitutionality of the protocol. The U.S. Supreme Court intervened. The legal question was whether condemned prisoners could file civil rights actions to challenge arguably unconstitutional methods of execution. Justice Sandra Day O'Connor was especially active during the oral argument, asking me lots of questions about the propriety of correctional staff engaging in medical procedures. The court ruled unanimously in our favor, deciding that a condemned prisoner could challenge unconstitutional methods of execution by filing a civil rights case. David Nelson died of natural causes a year after we won relief. Following the Nelson litigation, questions about the drug combination that most states use to carry out lethal injections arose. Many states were using drugs that had been banned for animal euthanasia because they caused a painful and torturous death. The drugs weren't readily available in the United States, and so states had started importing them from European manufacturers. When the news spread that the drugs were being used in executions in the United States, European producers stopped making them available. The drugs became scarce, which prompted state correctional authorities to obtain them illegally, without complying with FDA rules that regulate the interstate sale and transfer of drugs. Drug raids of state correctional facilities were a bizarre consequence of this surreal drug dealing to carry out executions. The U.S. Supreme Court in Bays v. Rees later held that the execution protocols and drug combinations weren't inherently unconstitutional. The executions would resume. What that meant for Alabama death row prisoners and EJI staff was 17 executions in 30 months. It happened at the same time that we were representing children sentenced to life without parole all over the country. I'd flown to South Dakota, Iowa, Michigan, Missouri, Arkansas, Virginia, Wisconsin, and California to argue cases on behalf of condemned children over the preceding months. The courts, procedures, and players were all different, and the travel was exhausting. We were still very actively litigating on behalf of condemned children in Mississippi, Georgia, North Carolina, Florida, and Louisiana, southern states where we had litigated previously. And, of course, our Alabama docket had never been more jammed or demanding. In a 2-week period, I'd been in California visiting Antonio Nunez at a remote prison in the middle of the state before arguing his case in an appellate court there, while also actively trying to win relief for Trina Garnett in Pennsylvania and Ian Manuel in Florida. I had visited Ian and Joe Sullivan in a Florida prison, and both of them were struggling. Prison officials weren't allowing Joe to have regular access to his wheelchair, and he had fallen repeatedly and injured himself. Ian was still in isolation. Trina's medical condition was worsening. I was having an increasingly difficult time managing it all. At the same time, Walter's authorized length of stay at the Montgomery facility was up, so we frantically made arrangements for him to move back home, where his sister would do the best she could to take care of him. It was a worrisome situation for him and his family, for all of us. By the time Jimmy Dill was scheduled for execution in Alabama, the entire EJI staff was exhausted. The execution date couldn't have come at a more difficult time. We had no prior involvement in Mr. Dill's case, which meant getting up to speed in the 30 days before his scheduled execution. It was an unusual crime. Mr. Dill was accused of shooting someone during the course of a drug deal after an argument erupted. The shooting victim did not die. Mr. Dill was arrested and charged with aggravated assault. He was in jail for 9 months awaiting trial while the victim was released from the hospital and was recovering fine. But after several months of caring for him at home, the victim's wife apparently abandoned him, and he became gravely ill. When he died, state prosecutors changed the charges against Mr. Dill from assault to capital murder. Jimmy Dill suffered from an intellectual disability and had been sexually and physically abused throughout his childhood. He struggled with drug addiction until his arrest. He was appointed counsel who did very little to prepare the case for trial. Almost no investigation was done into the poor medical care the victim had received, care that constituted the actual cause of death. The state made a plea offer of 20 years, but it was never adequately communicated to Mr. Dill. So he went to trial, was convicted, and was sentenced to death. The appellate courts affirmed his conviction and sentence. He couldn't find volunteer counsel for his post-conviction appeals, so most of his legal claims were procedurally barred because he had missed the filing deadlines. When we first looked at Mr. Dill's case a few weeks before his scheduled execution, no court had reviewed critical issues about the reliability of his conviction and sentence. Capital murder requires an intent to kill, and there was a persuasive argument that there was no intent to kill in this case, and that poor health care had caused the victim's death. Most gunshot victims don't die after 9 months, and it was surprising that the state was seeking the death penalty in this case. And the U.S. Supreme Court had previously banned the execution of people with mental retardation, so Mr. Dill should have been shielded from the death penalty because of his intellectual disability. But no one had investigated or presented evidence in support of the claim. Along with his other challenges, Mr. Dill had enormous difficulty speaking. He had a speech impediment that caused him to stutter badly. When he became excited or agitated, it got worse. Because he had not previously had a lawyer who would see him or speak to him, Mr. Dill saw our intervention as something of a miracle. I sent my young lawyers to meet with him regularly after we got involved, and Mr. Dill called me frequently. We tried frantically to get the courts to issue a stay based on the new issues we'd uncovered, to no avail. Courts are deeply resistant to reviewing claims once a condemned prisoner has completed the appeals process the first time. Even the claim of mental retardation was thwarted because no court would grant a hearing at such a late stage. Although I knew the odds were against us, Mr. Dill's severe disabilities had made me privately hopeful that maybe a judge would be concerned and at least let us present additional evidence. But every court told us, too late. On the day of the scheduled execution, I once again found myself talking to a man who was about to be strapped down and killed. I had asked Mr. Dill to call throughout the day because we were waiting to hear the outcome of our final stay request at the U.S. Supreme Court. Early in the day, he sounded anxious, but he kept insisting that things would work out, and he told me he wasn't going to give up hope. He tried to express his gratitude for what we had done in the weeks leading up to his execution. He thanked me for sending staff down to visit him regularly. We had located family members with whom he had reconnected. We told him that we believed that he had been unfairly convicted and sentenced. Even though we hadn't yet persuaded a court to stay his execution, our efforts seemed to help him cope. But then the Supreme Court denied our final request for a stay of execution, and there was nothing else to do. He would be executed in less than an hour, and I had to tell him that the court would not grant him a stay. I felt overwhelmed. We spoke on the phone shortly before he was taken into the execution chamber. Listening to him was hard. He was stuttering worse than usual and having great difficulty getting his words out. The imminent execution had unnerved him, but he was trying valiantly to express his gratitude for our efforts. I sat for a long time holding the phone while he strained to speak. It was heartbreaking. At one point, I remembered something I had completely forgotten until that moment. When I was a boy, my mother took me to church. When I was about 10 years old, I was outside of our church with my friends, one of whom had brought a visiting relative to the service. The visiting child was a shy, skinny boy about my height who was clinging to his cousin nervously. He didn't say anything as the group of us chatted away. I asked him where he was from, and when this child tried to speak, he stumbled horribly. He had a severe speech impediment and couldn't get his mouth to cooperate. He couldn't even say the name of the town where he lived. I had never seen someone stutter like that. I thought he must have been joking or playing around, so I laughed. My friend looked at me worriedly, but I didn't stop laughing. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw my mother looking at me with an expression I'd never seen before. It was a mix of horror, anger, and shame, all focused on me. It stopped my laughing instantly. I'd always felt adored by my mom, so I was unnerved when she called me over. When I got to her, she was very angry with me. "What are you doing?" "What? I didn't do..." "Don't you ever laugh at someone because they can't get their words out right. Don't you ever do that." "I'm sorry." I was devastated to be reprimanded by my mom so harshly. "Mom, I didn't mean to do anything wrong." "You should know better, Brian." "I'm sorry. I thought..." "I don't want to hear it, Brian. There is no excuse, and I'm very disappointed in you. Now, I want you to go back over there and tell that little boy that you're sorry." "Yes, ma'am." "Then I want you to give that little boy a hug." "Huh?" "Then I want you to tell him that you love him." I looked up at her and, to my horror, saw that she was dead serious. I had reacted as apologetically as I possibly could, but this was way too much. "Mom, I can't go over and tell that boy I love him. People will..." She gave me that look again. I somberly turned around and returned to my group of friends. They had obviously seen my mother scolding. I could tell because they were all staring at me. I went up to the little boy who had struggled to speak. "Look, man, I'm sorry." I was genuinely apologetic for laughing and even more deeply regretful of the situation I'd put myself in. I looked over at my mother, who was still staring at me. I lunged at the boy to give him a very awkward hug. I think I startled him by grabbing him like that, but when he realized that I was trying to hug him, his body relaxed, and he hugged me back. My friend looked at me oddly as I spoke. "I love you." I tried to say it as insincerely as I could get away with and half smiled as I spoke. I was still hugging the boy so he couldn't see the disingenuous look on my youthful face. It made me feel less weird to smile like it was a joke. But then the boy hugged me tighter and whispered in my ear. He spoke flawlessly, without a stutter and without hesitation. "I love you too." There was such tenderness and earnestness in his voice, and just like that, I thought I would start crying.